Welcome to Heart Yoga Radio. It's the 15th of August 2018. Today's question is, what is art? So I'm coming to this not so well prepared. I did study philosophical aesthetics 25 years ago, 30 years ago I think even. And what I did discover during that period of study was that question, what is art, is not so easy. Of course we could go and look it up in the dictionary, but I don't think that would help us very much. And it's an interesting question because it has wider applicability beyond simply the matter of the nature of art. And that discovery has stuck with me through the various philosophical labyrinths that I've been in over the years. This is not an easy question. Well, I can tell you some of the ways that people have attempted to answer the question. And I think I can work out from scratch what the possible approaches are going to be, and I will attempt an answer, though that answer won't really be a conclusion. Now you can attempt to define art, and that brings us into the whole conundrum of definition. Naively, we expect words to have definitions. But the truth is that very, very many words function without definitions. And I'll put it to you that art is one of them. Now, a definition has got a technical definition for certain types of philosophers. And they would say that to define something, to define something that a word can represent in some way, is to supply necessary and sufficient conditions for that something to be, truly, worthy of the name that we've given to it. So you could say a horse was a mammalian, four-legged, quadruped, gramnivorous, as Mr. Gradgrind would have it, and so on. So you can kind of list a set of necessary and sufficient conditions. So what is a necessary condition? What's a sufficient condition? Now, to be a horse, and there is the necessary condition that the entity X is an animal. But it's not a sufficient condition for X to be a horse. And if it was a sufficient condition, I would be a horse, because I'm an animal. And the neighbour's cat would be a horse, because it's an animal. And the earthworm that's just on the path there would be a horse, because it's an animal. So I think that points out what a necessary condition is. Now, a sufficient condition for something X to be a horse would be the presence of horse DNA in a blood sample taken from the horse, and no other DNA, no human DNA, no cat DNA, no earthworm DNA, that would be sufficient. So these are necessary and sufficient conditions. So there have been various attempts to provide sets, or even complex sets of necessary and sufficient conditions for an object to be a work of art, or for a person's activity to be, to render them an artist. And I suppose those would be the ways to go. You know, you go for something concrete, the artist or the work of art. If you're going to get then at this kind of generalised thing, art. So there have been various attempts, well, I should actually say like lots of attempts to work along that route. And some focus on the work of art, some focus on the act of creation, some focus on the nature of the artist and so on. And you could probably figure this out, but sets of necessary and sufficient conditions can be quite complex. They can be disjunctive. It'd be like a load of if-then statements that you might get in a computer program. There might even be some negatives, things that have to be absent, and so forth. The thing with art is that you always find a counter-example. You can always come up with something that everybody recognises as a work of art. Well, certainly experts recognise as a work of art, but it doesn't fit, it sort of breaks some of your conditions. And you find this with any, when you have a word that's describing something very varied and complex, internally varied and complex. And yet somehow we're still able to recognise that something as having some kind of unity, because art, obviously, we have a term, so there is some kind of like unity as well. And attempts to define art along the route of definition, in that strict philosophical sense, of providing sets of necessary and sufficient conditions which have to be met, has proved, I would say, futile. Now Wittgenstein, in his second phase, thought that there were a lot of terms that we use in our ordinary discourse which evaded definition in just this way. And he wanted to know how they worked, and he came up with the idea of family resemblances. You can find this in Philosophical Investigations, where it's well described. So what's this about? What's this notion, family resemblances? And if you imagine you go to a stately home and there are portraits along the corridor and up the stairs of the ancestors of the family and all the branches of the family. And even though every face is distinct, you can still say, oh, well, that person's a Brown or a Smith. And it might be two of them have got the same nose or a similar nose, but different eyes. But person X has got the same, a very similar eyes to person Z, who's got the same tall stature as the great-grandfather of the thread. So, I mean, you can just do this with something quite simple, like trying to define a chair or a table. So a table has legs. Well, how many legs? Well, it could be three, could be four, could be five. But it's a bit of a family resemblance in the having of the legs. And so forth. And Wittgenstein likens it to a rope that's made up of fairly short strands of fibre, but they're all woven together, and the rope itself has got an integrity, even though it's only made up of lots of short strands of fibre overlapping. And it's that, in that overlap, that family resemblances allows us to say he's a Smith, you know, or it's a table. I mean, you could devise something quite outlandish and still recognise it as a table. And you'd have a bit of a game trying to fit the strangeness of our novel table into any set of necessary and sufficient conditions. So Wittgenstein thought, and illustrated quite convincingly, that a lot of terms behave in this way. Some terms behave by definition, but a good many don't. So there have been people who've tried to say, well, this is the way to go in defining art. Let's talk about family resemblances rather than strict conditional definitions. And that sort of works up to a point. It works until you hit Dada. And if you remember, the initiatory moment of Dada was in the first half of the 20th century, was Marcel Duchamp's exhibition of a urinal, a ceramic urinal, signed R. Mutt, and it's called Fountain, and he just had some big establishment art exhibition, exhibited the fountain. Well, so obviously there's a furore about that. And people say, well, it's actually like it's just a fucking urinal. And well, why is it art? Well, it's art because Marcel Duchamp asserts that it's art. And it's there, it's in the institution, in one of the hallowed institutions of art being exhibited. And that makes it art. And of course, Duchamp was able to assert that. And the art world is still in the midst of the unfolding of the implications of that single gesture of Marcel Duchamp. Now, you make yourself into a work of art. You know, Tracy Emin's tent is a work of art for precisely that reason. Yeah. And of course, all of the prior legacy modalities, painting, drawing, sculpture, weren't swept aside by that. They still exist, but there's this whole other thing pops up, this whole other way, you might say, doing visual philosophy perhaps, or experiential philosophy, if you want to get fancy. So that kind of, in a sense, is going to sweep away family resemblance as well, because what's been introduced is the idea of the fiat of the artist. The artist, let it be thus. The artist's assertion of a designation of something, some event, some object, some intangible, as a work of art. And maybe to reinforce that with some institutional acceptance, just by getting in an exhibition somewhere. But you can see that even that isn't necessary. Now this is actually huge in some ways. Actually, family resemblance is huge, if I can have a little digression. Basically, Platonism, in which we have the idea that there is an ultimate chair of which all the world's real chairs are copies, is really about definition. That set of necessary and sufficient conditions, should we arrive at it, is the ideal. It exists in the empyrean of conceptuality. Whereas, and okay, there's the Aristotelian version of that, in which the ideal, the real, ultimately real prototype of chair is somehow embedded within the real instantiations of chairs, as opposed to being in some conceptual empyrean. But nevertheless, we have this same result, and it's a result that forces us almost willingly to understand language as being entirely dependent on definitions. So Wittgenstein's convincing demonstration of the way much language works through family resemblances, actually it upends Platonism. The great thread that runs through Western philosophy. There it is, Wittgenstein upended it. I don't think that many people see that, because it's that upending is embedded in these really esoteric concerns about language use. And done in quite a sort of gnomic way, because Wittgenstein's method is just simply to show us with examples. And we have to do quite a lot of the work ourselves to figure out what's going on. But if you fit that in this panoptic vision of Western philosophy, you just see how huge it was. But of course, now art is coming along and is going to upend even that, can subvert that, disrupt even that. That something can be a work of art because we say it is. It can even be a nothing, it can be an event. And of course, we had, very big in the 60s, the notion of the event being a work of art, and I suppose theatre has always done that. And film and so on, and various types of performance have always been working with just the notion of the event rather than the object. So how this pans out for discourse in general, just beyond art, is of course it pushes us into that Nietzschean thing of not laying the spade down too soon. It shows a preparedness to disrupt, to go a bit further, even if it seems absurd at first, to keep mining, to keep pressing, to assert as well, to assert the artist's will to power. I think for debate and explaining stuff and public discourse, obviously this is a new layer of onerous requirements. And people are not even availing themselves of family resemblances, let alone the idea that you can explode a concept and that can be a part of its very nature. And I suppose this brings me to my sort of quasi conclusion that art is an explosive concept, because the practitioners of art, the artists, can explode the concept and will attempt to explode the concept ever since Marcel Duchamp's fountain. And there are probably in other artistic fields some similar examples. So there's, I suppose, my slightly hippie-ish and excessive way of describing this, to say that art's an explosive concept. It's ready to explode and disrupt its own trajectory at any moment. It just needs somebody to come along who can do it, who will do it, and the conditions that just bring all that to fruition. So, again, I haven't really named so many names in this, but a lot of distinguished philosophers have thought about this whole matter. I'm thinking of, in recent years, Collingwood, Dickey, I think it was a guy called Binkley who drew attention to the artist acting by fiat, to say that XYZ is art, thereby exploding the quest for definition and probably even the quest for some description of art in terms of family resemblances. I think that was Binkley. But I say it's a long time since I looked at some of this stuff, so do your own research. But just backtracking a little bit, you can see that, you know, there's at least these two ways to go anyway, that we can be thinking about the work of art, put all of our focus on that, what makes this object or this event a work of art. And, then you can go down various lanes, you can try for definition. There have been some valiant attempts to do that, but they fall short. Because we can find counterexamples. But I suppose Binkley's thing, he says, well, we can even create counterexamples, come up with a definition, and I'll find something that doesn't fall within your definition and declare that it's a work of art, and then you're fucked. But there's also another another way of looking at it, and it looks at the creativity of the artist. What's going on there? And okay, you can try and isolate that from conditions and be very psychological and phenomenological about that. You could perhaps go for some kind of Freudian framework that helped you to examine the psychology and give an account of the psychology of creating something. And work that went along that line, again going back some years, probably 1960 or something, was somebody I've mentioned before, Anton Ehrenzweig, who wrote a Psychoanalysis and Art. And he tried to give an account of creativity, the work of the artist in these terms. It's very useful, actually, I find. But we have this other approach, which is still focusing on the artist and the creative processes, that will want to place the artist in a context. And that means, well, a market, for instance. Yeah, and a society, and for it to be doing certain jobs in a society according to the structure of that society and its needs of its creatives. So you get something like the Nazi art, you know, this kind of like an attempt at a hyper-realism, but very kitschy and very schlocky. And then the socialist realism of the Stalinists, where the artist is functionary of the state and has got to do what he's told. Or you could think of something like Gainsborough's Mr. and Mrs. Andrews, which he paints a picture of some landed gentry set against a landscape of their property, with their dogs, their pedigree dogs, and their horse, and the land that they own. And presumably he was commissioned and paid to do that. And you could give a complete account of what's going on there in terms of changes the economy and the class relations are undergoing in 18th century England. And you can give very full accounts of specific instances of creativity, of artistic production, of artists in terms of the context, economic, social and cultural context in which they're embedded, and the functions that they're fulfilling within that context. Now, I think we're used to thinking of the artist as the bourgeois artist, you know, the great outsider hero, Van Gogh, still immensely popular. He's a bloke who did his own thing and was isolated from the context except for, you know, the life of the pub and the life of the village. But was really there on his own and having to beg money from his brother and all the rest of it. So he kind of, his links with the economy are sort of tenuous and insecure. And that gives us that picture of the lone explorer, the hero of creativity, who might lose his sanity in the process. But we need to remember that artists function in a lot of other contexts and should be a bit cautious about taking the bourgeois artist as the model. So, I mean, all I've done there is try to indicate ways we can go. Okay, I'm just going to try and summarise the main features of what I've just said. Well, we can think about art and works of art and artists in terms of definitions. I think we're likely to find that we're not going to completely succeed with that, though there have been some attempts. That led me onto a discussion of definition of per se, and an aside that's not such an aside regarding Wittgenstein's insight into the way language utilises family resemblances in order to function, and that we might apply that to works of art, given the difficulty in finding a definition in terms of necessary and sufficient conditions. We find that that is quite useful, but it gets subverted by Dada, You might say, oh, by the way the artist can act by faith, by declaring something a work of art. And in that you do see a bit of a role of what you might call institutional sanction as well. In the midst of that discussion, I tried to broaden it out to say that Wittgenstein's work on family resemblances in language actually subverts Platonism, which has been a really formative thread, perhaps the formative thread, through Western philosophy and spreading out from there into our political theory, cultural theory, religion, and all manner of aspects of our lives. And then there's this esoteric work on language actually subverts that. And it's huge, though it looks very modest. But it's still helping us only to do so much work around trying to answer this question, what is art? And to give some kind of account of art. I then sort of backtracked to the obvious, which is that we can consider it under the rubric of the artist, or we can consider it under the rubric of the work of art. Under the rubric of the work of art, we are most tempted, I would say, to go for definitions and necessary and sufficient conditions, even if those definitions might be disjunctive, i.e. very complex. On the other hand, if we focus on the figure of the artist and the creativity of the artist to try and get some purchase on the question, what is art? We can kind of isolate the artist and be very concerned with the psychology of the artist and the phenomenology of creativity, perhaps. And I would say you could do both of these, and or you look at the context and you see the artist is embedded in his culture and try and figure out his activity in the light of that context, which of course it's economic, it's cultural, it's to do with who can pay, it's to do with the mode of life of the artist and all manner of things. I would add here, that I didn't mention before, including art education, the way people get to become artists. Do they go to art school? Do they work as an apprentice in an artist atelier? Or they do, they become like the lone outsider who just follows his way or whatever. And that's more or less the structure of what I've just said. So I hope it was, any of you artistic wallers, I hope it was helpful. I hope I've shown, if nothing else, what a difficult question it is. I think this is what I do mostly. I attempt to show people that the answers that they're coming up with to what seem like naive questions are very, very often inadequate if you just kind of dig a little deeper. Okay, thanks for listening. Speak soon. Over and out.